Welcome back to Stacktrace, the show that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspective. And those two developers are, just like always, me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo.
Hi, John.
So before we begin this week's episode, we just wanted to take a moment to voice our support for the Black Lives Matter movement and to really emphasize that we strongly condemn violence, racism, and hatred. So this is a tech podcast where we're always talking about tech and developer-focused topics, and we have a whole episode ahead of us full of discussing all sorts of tech-related topics, but both me and Rambo still thought that it was important to publicly show our support right here at the beginning of this episode, as we have through other channels, and to make it crystal clear that we are 100% against racism and that we 100% believe that Black Lives Matter. We also really want to recommend listening to another podcast here on the 9 to 5 network called Watch Time. On the latest episode, our friend and fellow iOS developer Ish Shabazz was a special guest to discuss the topic of racism and to tell firsthand stories of how racism is much more common and affects many more people than you might think. And that's sadly not just in the US, but also here in Europe and in other places around the world as well. So we highly recommend listening to that episode, and we'll leave a link in the show notes to it. Finally, we also want to point out that, just like we occasionally did throughout the coronavirus crisis, which honestly is still going on in many parts of the world, that if we appear joyful or happy here on the show, and if we say things like, we're doing great, we don't want anyone to interpret that as if we're ignoring what's going on in the world around us or that we don't take these things seriously, because we really do. But despite everything that is going on around the world, we will try to remain as positive as we can, not because we don't care, but because we're trying to stay positive, we're trying to stay motivated, and we're trying to make this show the very best that it can be. So with that being said, let's start the show. Rambo, what have you been up to?
I have been working on Chibi Studio again.
That's really cool. You seem to have been really doubling down on Chibi Studio lately. Is this like a Chibi Studio part of your life?
Yeah, definitely. I still have Everybody 2, of course, that I'm working on, but I feel like I have some more urgent things to take care of. There are two projects that are live, and of course, I need to keep supporting them. So for Chibi Studio, I spent some time this weekend reorganizing the project in Xcode, which sounds like not that interesting, but I think it was a really important thing that I did this right now. And I say that because WWDC is just around the corner, and we're going to talk a bit more about it soon. And we don't know what's going to happen and what types of new things Apple is going to announce. And this project has been going on since 2016. So it wasn't very well organized in Xcode. I think every iOS developer has experienced this, where you have your Xcode project and there are files everywhere and you don't really know where they are and what they do, and there's things in there that aren't even being used anymore. So I think it's good to every now and then have a look and clean up your project organization. And in my case, it went a little bit further than that, because I had my project was still using, I'm going to call it the old way, which is when Xcode, when you created a new quote folder inside of your Xcode project, it didn't create an actual folder on disk. It only created a group, and the file itself was inside the same folder as everything else. So it was still like that. And what I did is I just took everything out and I created folders on the file system and dragged everything back in with this neat little folder structure. I think it makes things much better. And another thing I had done was to have separate projects for some of the shared frameworks I use. Like I mentioned before, we have this Mac app, an app kit Mac app we use for creating content for the app, and it shared a framework with the iOS app. But this framework was in a separate project, as well as the editor itself. And because when I created this, I didn't know any better, I actually had two targets for this core framework that's shared between the apps, and one for iOS and another one for the Mac. But it wasn't really necessary, but I didn't really know any better when I created it. So I had two separate targets, and this caused all sorts of issues. I couldn't, for instance, work on the Mac app and the iOS app at the same time, because those two projects couldn't be opened at the same time in Xcode.
Really? Is that because they were sharing like a local framework, and then Xcode will complain that this framework is open, or this project is open in another workspace?
Yeah, exactly. And there are lots of things you can do, like you can, I don't know, use CocoaPods or something like that. But I don't really like using third-party dependency management when I can avoid it. And this is a project that where the only person who's writing code is me. So there really is no point in having some super complicated dependency management system, or even having each framework be its separate project doesn't really make sense, because they are going to share build configurations and code signing things, and I don't really have to worry about conflicts with Git stuff because it's just me. So I just wiped it clean and created new targets within the main Xcode project. And now everything lives in this one Xcode project, and I can build and run any target I like at any time without having to worry about crazy situations like not being able to open the same project twice or something like that. And I actually, within the project, I created those Xcode groups to organize things. And there's screenshots on my Twitter of this project organization if you want to have a look. So it's really neat now. I'm really happy about this.
That sounds really nice, because these types of tasks is like, they can take a lot longer than what you initially might think, right? Where yep. You think like, oh, I'm just going to move some things around and make folders out of them and organize my project. And then 3 days later, you're still doing that same thing. Because sometimes it can be really tricky when you have these hard referenced paths in your project file. For example, for your info.plist, that's a classic one where If you move that and all sorts of things starts to explode, and then you have to like go in and change that path in the build settings. And there's a lot of different things that can happen when you start moving things around like that. So it can usually take some time, but once you're done and once you have that neat folder structure and everything is kind of in place, it feels so great. It really does feel like cleaning your house. And of course, when you clean your house, you shouldn't just put everything in the basement, right? Like, you should actually organize things. And I think, you know, that it seems like what you've done here. And I also have gone through some of my projects recently and done the same thing. And it is really satisfying when things are finally in order.
Yeah, absolutely. And now I'm ready to do new things when they come at DubDub and not have to worry about weird Xcode project configurations and things like that. And what you mentioned is really true. Like, this was a much bigger task than I thought it would be. Like, it took me probably in total like 10 hours of work to get this all done, because it's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of old code. There was a situation where I had two separate targets for the Mac app, and conditionally linking something into a target is not as easy as just having two separate targets. And I had a framework that should only be linked in the iOS version, but not the Mac version. So I actually took those pieces that depended on that framework, which should probably have been separated to begin with, and created yet another framework from those. And then the Mac just links against that one. So it's a puzzle.
Yeah, it really is. But that is a very, very good point that you bring up there. And that's a very powerful tool to have in terms of resolving these kind of circular dependencies that you can end up with. Because as you start modularizing a project and as you split things up into frameworks, it's very easy to end up with circular dependencies where you have two frameworks that essentially need to reference each other. And a typical example of that would be to have like a networking library that also needs to know about your models, because they are going to be decoded when you're performing your networking. And then the model library also needs some stuff from the networking because it needs to like define endpoints or something. So then you have that circular dependency. You have two things referencing each other. And what you just mentioned there, like creating a kind of middle person or like a separate third party, not third party dependency, but third party in terms of the cycle framework that can kind of act as a mediator between the two can be really, really powerful in those occasions. So in my example here of networking and models, you could have a third library, for example, that defines the endpoints and defines everything that it needs to be shared between your model code and your networking code. And then your networking library can just contain the actual networking, like downloading the bytes over the internet and all of the things, maybe caching and things like that. And then your model library can just contain the model code. So that's something I think that is very good to keep in mind if you start to modularize a code base or when reorganizing, just like you did.
Yeah, and the rest was just making sure to put like if OS, iOS in things that are iOS only and things like that. So fortunately, the availability conditional compiling stuff these days is really good. So it's very easy to not compile some piece of code if you're compiling against a specific SDK or something like that. So that was not the main problem. It was mainly just organizing things. And it's good that I managed to delete also a bunch of stuff that I noticed wasn't being used. So I'm very happy with it.
Just like, again, cleaning in normal life, right?
Yeah.
Like you realize that some things you don't need, you can throw them away. And another thing there, which I also think is an interesting point, is that when you are reorganizing a project, you can sometimes find out that something was wrong or that you had such a circular dependency that we just mentioned or that something about your architecture maybe doesn't make any sense and it was kind of hidden from you when everything was in either one target or when things were linking against each other like you just mentioned or when it was kind of messy. But then as you start kind of pulling these threads and you start organizing things, you realize that this could actually use a bit of refactoring. So it can also be a great tool in general just to kind of check your overall architecture and check, you know, how things are in relation to each other and how they depend on each other, because these types of issues would kind of bubble to the surface when you start reorganizing and actually splitting things up.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. So John, I want to hear, what have you been up to?
So more or less the same update as last week, actually. I'm still working on WWDC by Sundell and Friends, the new website for covering WWDC, which is coming up quicker than I thought in the beginning of this month when I started working on this. And I thought, oh, I have so many weeks left. It's great. But now it's really getting there, because as we record, it's a little bit more than a week left until the site will be launched, because it's launching a few days before WWDC kicks off. But everything is more or less in order right now. I think its site is mostly finished, which probably means that it's just 90% left of the work, right? That's what you always say. Oh, it's 90% done. It's just 90% left. One interesting thing, though, that I wanted to bring up here, and it's kind of interesting because it also relates a lot to what you were just talking about around kind of, you know, reorganizing your project and essentially dealing with legacy and fixing and reorganizing that legacy code. I also had to figure out how I was going to deal with my legacy implementation of last year's website. So last year, I also ran WWDC by Sundell, and I was very, very happy when I realized that I had done myself a huge favor. You know, you always love when that happens, when your past self did your future self a favor by actually namespacing all of last year's URLs with 2019.
Oh.
So all of the URLs were like, you know, wwcbysundell.com/2019/ then the name of the article. So that was great when I realized that, because I was thinking before, like, how will I solve this? I will need to, like, you know, have this map on my server that kind of redirects to another URL or something, but I didn't have to do any of that. But still, I had to figure out, like, how do I actually treat this code? Because my website from last year was not implemented using publish. It was implemented using a kind of predecessor to publish, like a alpha version of it, if you will.
MVP.
Right, exactly. A literal MVP. And I've thought a lot about it during this past, like, you know, 6 months or so. Should I rewrite WWC by Sundell using Publish as well? And I started doing that a few times just to kind of check that Publish's API was okay for that website as well, just to have like two data points before I open sourced it. But I didn't finish that task, and I felt like that was too big to do right now, just before WWC. So I did kind of a pragmatic decision here where, instead of saying, you know, let's rewrite this from scratch, which is a very typical way of handling these things, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, I have this piece of legacy, let me rewrite it using the new framework so that everything is kind of normalized and everybody's happy. I instead did the thing where, since I had this HTML already generated, and it's kind of read-only at this point, I'm not going back and updating the 2019 articles.
Yeah.
So I just took that generated HTML, and I basically started treating it as resources. So I put it in my resources folder, in my new project, in a 2019 folder, and then I have a publishing step that essentially takes that HTML and copies it into the new website under the 2019 folder as well, so the URLs are maintained. And I just thought that's kind of an interesting thing to bring up here, because I think a lot of the times when we talk about, you know, refactoring, reorganization, restructuring, you know, rewriting with new architectures, it's also always important to keep in mind that sometimes the pragmatic decision, or the decision you might make for various reasons, is to just keep things as they were in your legacy code and kind of, again, treat that as just like this read-only part of your code base, and then use the new architecture and the new tools to implement the new thing and kind of have the two stay separate. And it's not always possible, but in this case it was, and that's why I chose this approach.
Yeah, I love your mention of your past self there, because that's one of the things that I always think about when doing work is, think about the things you won't be able to fix later, and
right.
or at least not easily. And one of them would be like the namespacing of the URLs, like you mentioned. URLs are kind of important, and you can't just go changing them willy-nilly because things are going to break. Just ask Apple developer documentation. They love changing their URLs all the time.
Right.
Something that always comes to mind when I do similar stuff is versioning and version checks. Like, we have this timeline tab in Chibi Studio, and the first version we made didn't have the concept of versioning, so there was no way for like to change the format and give a signal to old clients that like, this is something you don't understand, don't even bother trying to parse this, which is not that big a problem on iOS usually, because people tend to update really quickly. But if you want to have like a service online that's stable and that keeps working for a long time, you do have to think about this type of thing, like where you can't go back and change something.
Absolutely. Versioning is really key, like you just mentioned, like to have versioning both in your backend endpoints, but also sometimes in your data models. It can be really, really nice to add versioning because it's so easy, right? You just add that integer version, right? Or maybe a double, but an integer is usually good enough because, well, if you have a 64-bit integer, you have a lot of versions ahead of you before that's going to run out of numbers.
Yeah.
Because it just saves you so much time in the future when you do have to make breaking changes, and then you can use that version to inspect, you know, what version are you dealing with? Are you going to use this decoder or this decoder, or are you going to handle it this way or that way? And another thing I want to bring up here as well is kind of the concept of end of life. We tend to not think about something that it's going to at some point have an end of life when we are developing it, because, you know, it's the beginning of the life and we yeah. are really excited about launching it. But at some point, especially when we're talking about backend services, they are probably going to be shut off or migrated to something else, and clients become obsolete. And having something in place there where you are able to message your users one way or another without maybe spamming them with push notifications, but giving them some kind of notice that this is in fact now an obsolete version is also something that can be really, really good to invest in, just to, again, do your future self a favor. So it can be something simple as, in your backend response to have a key that is optional, which contains a message. And then when the client decodes that backend response and it sees that there's a message there, it just displays it in an alert view or something. Because that enables you to put a message in there saying that this version is now obsolete, please download the new version from the App Store or something. And that just little thing, that string that is there, which can literally be implemented in like 10 lines of code or something, can just save you so much pain in the future.
Absolutely. I think the best example we have of this in practice is when you try to log in with your Apple ID on like an iPhone 3G running iPhone OS 2 or something, and you have two-factor authentication, which did not exist back then, you get an alert and it says, oh, please enter your two-factor codes at the end of your password. Like
that's so cool.
Yeah, they had thought about, we need to have some sort of server-side defined flow so that in the future we can keep this working. Like, it's amazing. I have an iPhone 1 here. I don't remember which version of iPhone OS it's running, but in that iPhone, I can log in with my Apple ID, which has two-factor, and I can enter my two-factor credentials, and it will log me in, and I can like go to the App Store and download apps. It's amazing.
Yeah, that is really amazing. And it just shows like a really strong commitment to backwards compatibility, which, you know, to be fair, is not something we always see from Apple, you know, deprecating OpenGL, you know, and things like that. But in this case, it really is the case. And that is so great to see. I've said this many times before, but I really think backwards compatibility is very beautiful. And I know sometimes it's not practical and it can slow you down and it can create tech debt to have to like always maintain some kind of backwards compatibility approach. But when you can have a piece of code that it can stay backwards compatible without a ton of like ugly hacks, then I just find that so beautiful and so nice when you have that nice, you know, migration process of your backend or of your code base in general to just like support all the new features while still gracefully falling back on older clients.
Absolutely.
Great. So speaking about new things, let's move into our In the News segment. How did you like that segue, Rambo?
Nice.
Pretty good one, right? Yeah. And this, we have actually a double In the News segment on this episode. And the first news segment that we have, or the first piece of news we have, is something that we've talked about in the past, and it's come up now again. We have a news story from Bloomberg about ARM Max. So Rambo, what's going on here?
So according to this Bloomberg piece, we have ARM Max coming, and they are going to be announced at WWDC.
That is super cool. That's been something that we've talked about a lot in the past, you know, during the past couple of years. You know, when will Apple actually announce a transition to ARM? Because it's always seemed like, or not always, but for the last couple of years, it's really seemed like more of an when rather than an if, right?
Yeah.
Because we've seen just how powerful their A series of chips have become. And Intel still has a lot of powerful chips in certain parts of the range, but, you know, an ARM laptop, how great wouldn't that be, right? I think that's something that a lot of people are excited about. So the new thing in this report is that it seems like there's going to be an announcement at WWDC, but they're also saying that it can actually change, so it doesn't have to be at WWDC, so maybe we should, you know, not be too excited about it. But it also seems like the rollout will take place in 2021, so it will kind of mimic the standard playbook of large architectural transitions like this, in that there's an announcement and then the actual rollout happens 1 year later because developers need to have time to update their apps.
I do think we're going to see an announcement at WWDC. And let me explain why I think that would make sense. Regardless of the timeline implications that it can change or it might not be quite ready yet, I think, well, if they're planning a rollout in the next year, this will be very likely the last WWDC before the rollout. Other than that, it's very likely that whatever needs to be done to the operating system and things like that in order for this to be feasible has already been done in a way that's very hard to take out. So it would leak regardless if they didn't talk about it. So I think the likelihood of we seeing some sort of announcement is extremely high. It's possible that it will be an announcement of just get ready and here's what you can do today to make sure when we release a development kit or something, your app will just compile by checking a checkbox.
So it would kind of be just like Catalyst, right? Where Apple actually announced that 1 year before they actually released Catalyst, because it was kind of like what you were just saying, that they probably knew that people like you and Steve Troughton Smith and other people would figure it out anyway. So they were just, let us just tell you right here, we do have this thing. It is currently in the OS. We're not going to share it with you publicly right now, but it's coming next year. So kind of like that.
And of course, a month later, Steve had an app running using it.
Right. And like a tool that would automatically convert your iOS app to it and all sorts of things. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's extremely likely that we see an announcement. But again, like you mentioned, maybe don't be too excited, because it could be really just an announcement and nothing like tangible that developers could actually do. My best case scenario for it would be for an announcement and, oh, and by the way, we're going to ship an IPSW you can flash into your iPad Pro, which is macOS. Like, that would be amazing.
That would be like Christmas or whichever other holiday you celebrate at the end of the year in June, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that would be really, really cool. Because they have two options, basically. I mean, I guess they have three, but the third one is awful. The third one would be, never mind, we're going to ship a MacBook Air or something next year and just buy that one and use it for testing. Like, that's not going to happen. The other one would be, here is a Mac Mini or something that has an ARM chip inside of it, and you can get one for $1 or something, like when they did the Apple TV thing. That has a lot of problems. I'm being very selfish right now, but it would probably not be available for developers in Brazil because importing that would be a pain. And I think Apple thinks about those issues and that not every developer lives in the US. There are high-profile apps all over the world that would need to be developed for this. So I think, and of course the first option, which is the one I would prefer, would be some sort of hardware we already have could be flashed with macOS. And I think a great candidate for that would be the latest iPad Pro, which has a decent chip inside of it. And if you have the Magic Keyboard with the trackpad, I mean, it's basically a question of running the software. Like it's just install macOS, John. Why is it
just
so hard?
Just install it. Exactly. I guess the only thing there that it could be a problem is the RAM, right? That the RAM is just 4 gigabytes on the previous model and 6 gigabytes on the new model, which is very low in terms of macOS. But it's like we've discussed on previous episodes, it could also be that they have done something to the system also to kind of re-architect it in a way, or, you know, tweak something. Just make it use less RAM, Rambo. Maybe that's what they've just done.
Yeah, but I guess 6 gigs, it can run on 6 gigs. Like, you're not going to be running Final Cut Pro or something, but
just don't open more than one Slack workspace and you're good.
Definitely not. I mean, it would probably be fine for a development kit for, like, 90% plus of apps out there.
Yeah. I also want to bring up a fourth option here, which is, imagine if Xcode came with a Mac simulator.
Oh.
So your Mac will run Mac. OS X runs OS X.
Wow. Well, it will have to be an emulator for the architecture.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It wouldn't even be just a simulator. It will be an actual emulator. Yeah.
Let's not do that.
No, skip that, Apple. Just give us the iPad version. That, if, you know, they probably haven't decided, right? Because, I mean, they have 1.5 weeks left, so
Yeah.
Now that you're listening to this, Apple, you can just use the iPad approach. That we think that's the best.
Thanks, Phil.
Awesome. So really exciting to see. And of course, we have on our next episode is going to be our poker episode, which we always do before big Apple events. We're going to do a special poker episode where we're going to place our bets on what's going to happen during WWDC. So stay tuned for that. We're probably going to have a lot more thoughts on ARM Max at that point. But we also want to discuss another news item on this episode, and that's dropping today as we record, which is that it seems like a new iMac might be also in store for WWDC. Or what do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, so according to the rumor, this would be a new model of iMac with, quote, iPad Pro design language, slim bezels, T2 chip, and yeah, that's really interesting.
That is super interesting. And there's been a lot of discussion about the iMac hardware in general during the past year or so, where, you know, looking at all the other laptops that they have, looking at the new Pro Display XDR, the iMac is still very elegant, but it kind of looks dated in terms of the bezels that it has, in terms of, you know, just the overall design language still looks a lot like 2012 when it actually came out, compared to like a 2020 or 2019 design language from Apple.
Yeah, absolutely. And you still have them selling iMacs with spinning hard drives, like it's the 90s or something.
Yeah, that should almost be illegal at this point to sell devices with spinning hard drives.
Yeah, it's a hazard.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think it's about time. Less revised in 2012, so it's a little bit old. And this would apparently also have the new AMD GPU in it. So yeah, I think that's really exciting. But what really gets me interested in this new iMac is the iPad Pro design language.
So would you say that the Pro Display XDR has an iPad Pro design language? Would you say that?
I don't think so. I think it has a Pro Display XDR design language.
it's Pro without the iPad, right? Just like Swift is Objective-C without the C.
Yeah. Another interesting fact about the iMac, and correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it the last Mac Apple still offers without the T2 chip?
Yeah, I believe so, because even the new MacBook Air has a T2, right?
Even the Mac Mini, yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I do believe so, that it must be just the iMac. Unless they are, you know, sometimes we find these things out when we make statements like these, like someone will tweet at us or we will get some message saying that, you know, they're still selling this model and it's something that you didn't believe, right?
The eMac G5.
Right. It's still on sale on Apple's website. If you know the URL, you can still order it. Sometimes that is just kind of mind-blowing, because maybe there's some part of the market, like some specific education thing or something, that is still buying a lot of these things. But I do believe in this case that it is true what you're saying, that the T2 chip is in all Macs except the iMac.
How much RAM is in the T2 chip?
Right. Maybe that can be our ARM emulator, right? Or it wouldn't be an emulator at that point. That would actually be you're running ARM. You're using your second computer inside of your computer to run your computer OS in a different version on your computer.
Yeah. I don't know if that would be technically possible. I'm sure someone will write to us, but that's an interesting thought.
Maybe it could use the CPU on the T2 chip, but the RAM from the actual Mac. How crazy wouldn't that be?
Yeah, that got me thinking. But moving on. John, speaking about this new iMac, what do you think happens to the iMac Pro? I'm going to say I think the iMac Pro is dead. I think the new iMac is going to replace it.
Yeah, I think it's probably likely that the high-end iMac will come with iMac Pro-like configurations, right? So It will come with Xeon processors. It will come with, you know, all the bells and whistles that iMac Pro customers expect. It's also likely, I think, that the whole lineup of this new iMac will utilize the new cooling system that is in the iMac Pro. If you take the cooling system away, if you say that this can have Xeon support, if it can have support for the more high-powered GPUs, then there's not really room for an iMac Pro in the lineup, right?
Yeah. And you know what, John? I think I'm going to buy this one.
Ooh, all right. Well, that's great. We need someone to review it on the show, right?
Yeah, because things have changed. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been staying home longer than usual. And yeah, having an iMac starting to make more sense. I was actually thinking about getting an iMac for a while now, but I didn't because it's been a long time since it's been refreshed, and I knew the iMac Pro was likely to not be updated like ever. So yeah, this is exciting.
Yeah, depending on the price, I'm also considering this computer. I am working mostly from home, and I have this idea that I've been, you know, actually doing for a while now, that I'm using the iPad as my travel computer. You know, remember when we used to go traveling, Rembo, back in the ancient history? And then to actually use my Mac as my home office, like work computer, like that. And right now, my laptop, my non-pro laptop, you know, that I love dearly, it has not left its stand in like 6 months. Like it's essentially a stationary computer for me, the way I have my setup. So using an iMac would make a lot more sense if, you know, there's a model that kind of fits my budget slash needs, you know, overall kind of striking a nice balance between that. Because I have a hard time justifying based on my work, you know, which is mostly, you know, Swift development, but not Swift development in the sense of doing like really, really crazy, like, you know, using hundreds of cores, super parallelized computing. Sometimes I do like multi-threaded work, of course, as a developer, but most of the time I don't need like the highest spec computer to do that. So it's been very hard for me to justify both the iMac Pro and the Mac Pro because they are just astronomical in terms of price. So it would be really nice to see a more scalable lineup here in the iMac where there is something for everybody, and a mid-range model with a good price would definitely be something I would consider.
Yeah, absolutely. The depending on price is always implicit when I talk about buying something. So
yeah, of course. Yeah. And it's one of those things where Apple has shown us in the last couple of years that they are willing to go literally above and beyond when it comes to pricing. You know, I don't think that anyone expected, for example, the Pro Display XDR to be priced like it was. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I mean, we can all have feelings about that $1,000 stand, you know, and things like that. But that's just the way it is, right? That's the way they've decided to price their products recently. And that's why I'm always hesitant to be too excited about new products, especially more high-end ones, because it just seems like they are kind of splitting the market into two groups. And it's the high-end pro market with really, really expensive devices. And then there's the low-end mid-range market with, I don't want to say cheap, but more reasonably priced, at least from my perspective, devices. So yeah, we'll see what's going to happen here. I really hope that this is something that a lot of people, including myself and you and other people, can buy without, like, you know, using all of our savings.
Yeah.
So let's see what's going to happen.
Yeah, to be fair, when the rumors were around about the 16-inch MacBook Pro, I really wanted the machine because it sounded like a great upgrade. But the rumors were like it was going to cost $5,000 or something. So I was like, nah, I'm never going to have this one. And when it came out, it turned out it was a little bit less expensive than the original 15-inch, and they replaced the 15-inch with this one. So yeah, you never know, but
yeah,
we'll
the 16-inch MacBook Pro is giving me some hope. It really is, because it seemed there for a while that they were really doing what I just mentioned, like really splitting the market up and saying, you know, for pro customers, we're just going to charge an arm and a leg, right? So hopefully that won't be the case here.
Yeah, the only thing that bothers me about the Pro Display XDR is the fact that they don't offer a display for normal people. Like,
right,
they
exactly.
Only have the crazy expensive one, which its price is justified, especially if you compare it with other similar displays, but yeah,
it never gets old to complain about Apple products being too expensive, right? Like, that's always been the case. It's always this, like, being an Apple fan is always this, has these, you know, duality to it, where on the one side we are excited about the devices, we're excited about technology, we, you know, they're really high quality and we really want them. but they've always been, you know, more expensive than the rest of the market. Sometimes that's justified. Sometimes it's hard to justify things like that. So it's always that battle you have with yourself, whether it's like, you know, should I do this or that? But yeah, hopefully this new iMac can fit into a lot of people's lives, including ours.
Definitely.
Awesome. So now let's segue into our deep dive. And on this episode, we want to take a deep dive into background operations on iOS. So it's sort of going to be a follow-up to last week's discussion about COVID-19 contact tracing apps. Because we mentioned on the previous episode that a big issue with some of these apps that have been developed by countries around the world is that when they're not using Apple's and Google's system for contact tracing, they have to rely on running Bluetooth in the background. And we mentioned on the previous episode that there's a lot of drawbacks to that. And one of those is background operations. And I saw a tweet, which we'll put a link to in the show notes. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the person right now, but there was a tweet with a screenshot from the Australian contact tracing app, which when you haven't run it in the background for a while, it just shows you a push notification and it just says, please open this app and so it can turn on Bluetooth. And that just seems like a really bad solution. You know, that doesn't seem like very user-friendly. So I thought this kind of is an interesting debate around why background operations are so restricted on iOS, because Apple is probably not doing this out of spite, right? Not to make things worse than they should be. So Rambo, what's your take on this? Like, why is it so difficult to develop software on iOS that runs in the background?
Well, it's not a secret to anyone that I am not a fan of the iOS background execution model. I think it had its place when they started out with the background stuff. I think it was in iOS 4, right?
With Grand Central Dispatch, revolutionary new technology then.
Yeah, so I'm not a fan of this model. I think it's old and clunky. So the way background execution works on iOS is basically, if you want to run any operation in the background as an iOS app, your entire app will be run in the background. It's going to start up your main app process. And of course, there are things you can do to like not load your UI, but then you have to worry about if your app has been started from the background and then the user taps its icon, it's still the same session. So then you have to bootstrap your UI. So it's clunky. Let's leave it at that. So
yeah.
That's how it works, and these restrictions have been in place because you can't just let apps run in the background forever or whenever they want to, because it's going to destroy your battery life, and also it's going to consume a lot of your memory and CPU and stuff like that. So there has to be some sort of restriction, of course, especially on mobile devices.
Yeah, and you just know that there's going to be certain companies that if they enabled any operations to be performed in the background at any point, you just know that there's certain companies out there, certain social network companies that should not be named, that would just take advantage of that and just like run all sorts of trackers in the background all the time and not care about the user experience or user's battery life, right? So it kind of feels a little bit like Apple is fighting a battle here where they want to protect the user experience, they want to protect the battery life, they presumably want to enable developers to do interesting things with their apps, and a lot of those interesting things do sometimes require background operations. And I think it's a common problem with iOS apps in general that they are so just in time that they always load their data right when it's needed, which sometimes can also lead to a poorer user experience where, you know, you're launching your app and then you have to wait for a while before it loads the data when it could have loaded that data all along. And there are APIs on iOS that have been introduced over the last few years that the system can kind of wake you up in the background and tell you, hey, now you can actually get the background session here and do load some data. But like you're saying, it's clunky, it's complicated. It always involves running the entire app, and it involves you as a third-party developer having to manage all these different sessions and whether you're in the background or you're not, and it's restricted. So it's not ideal, this whole setup.
Yeah, absolutely. And the clunkiness of how it works ends up causing issues, including like random crashes that happen because your app is in a weird state because it was started from the background. And I mean, of course, you should prepare for that situation and have code in your app to handle that. But in my opinion, it's about time that we as developers have the option to say, like, I want, say, background fetch, but I don't want you to run my app. I want it to run this extension. And just run, just run an extension.
How hard can it be? It's just instantiate the class and run it. Like, two lines of code, boom.
So they could implement an extension type that's like a background fetch extension. And it will have like a request handler, like many extensions have. And it will just tell you, hey, do a background fetch. You do the background fetch, store the data on your database that's shared with your app. And then when the user launches your app, the data is going to be there. And this would actually be better than running the entire app in the background. Because if you are running the entire app in the background, apps have lots of stuff that goes on when they launch. They most of the time they have lots of dependencies, so they load a bunch of frameworks into memory, and then those frameworks start doing their own thing, doing lots of network requests and things like that. So not only as an app developer do you have to worry about your own code running in the background and not doing things it shouldn't do when it's a background session, but you also have to worry about SDK developers. And let's be honest, they're not going to care. They're going to just run as if it's running in the foreground most of the time. And if you had this other option of just running an extension, you could have this tiny little piece of code that was machined to perfection, like Johnny Ive would say, to just do that one thing you need to do, which is do like an HTTP request, get the data, parse it, store it on your local database, and that's it. And you wouldn't have to worry about this huge complicated app full of dependencies starting up in the background.
Yeah, that would be really cool. And this is kind of getting me thinking around Grand Central Dispatch that we mentioned earlier. So what's so beautiful about Grand Central Dispatch, and it's honestly one of my favorite Apple technologies, it's so great because it takes something that is inherently very complex, background threading, or not just background threading, but threading, multi-threading in general, concurrency, and giving you this nice API on top of it, which is still really low level. So in Swift, you can just say, you know, take a queue, a operation queue, and just say async and give it a closure, and that's your background code, right? It's almost like it couldn't be simpler than that. And of course, there are things you have to keep in mind, like you have to then go back to the main queue in order to update your UI. And there are still things to keep in mind. But in general, Grand Central Dispatch is a very, very nice and beautiful abstraction for concurrency, I think. So wouldn't it be cool if there was something built into Grand Central Dispatch to actually make this, what you're just talking about, really easy, where you could invoke something that lives in another process, like lives in another extension, but from your main app code in a way that would look like you're calling into normal code in your target, but it's actually going over that XPC boundary, performing the work, and then coming back to you in a closure. I think that could be really cool because I think one danger with something like this as well, or something that could actually make it harder to adopt, is that if you have to manage all of those connections manually, it kind of becomes a big thing. It kind of becomes difficult to implement. So having something like Grand Central Dispatch or even built into GCD itself would be super cool, I think.
Well, let me tell you something. The XPC APIs, they work exactly like that. You have a protocol and you call a method in that protocol, and you can have like a completion handler. And to you, it just looks like you're calling any other method.
That's awesome. And I guess the only thing there would be to like be able to have a larger number of operations, because maybe you would want to have like one separate background task for different things on in your app and not just have one process that you're kind of talking to on a regular basis.
Yeah, but at the same time, I still think that the extension approach I mentioned wouldn't be too hard. Like, I think most iOS developers who would need to implement this are familiar with things like sharing user defaults or sharing a container on disk. I think that's not so alien to most iOS developers.
Right. And if it is alien to you, dear listener, then we'll leave a link in the show notes to an article I wrote about that.
Awesome.
Yeah. So there are definitely things that could happen here. And to make this kind of more powerful and to make the background APIs in general kind of more general purpose, because as it exists today, there are only like a small number, or maybe not so small, but there's a specific type of tasks that you are allowed to perform in the background. Things like audio playback or voice calling and things like that. They're mostly around tasks that you are commonly doing in the background and then can kind of fit into one of these categories, like navigation is another one of those. And although there have been many instances in the past where people have kind of fitted their thing into that one of those buckets in order to actually make it allowed, it would just be nice to just say, like you said, this is a thing of the past. Let's just enable it in a broader sense and enable any kind of logic that you want to run, but still have it controlled and still have it something where the system can kind of manage the memory, can manage the things, and it can probably also like disable operations if they're acting weirdly or if they're running all the time.
Yeah, they did introduce a new API in iOS 13, which made things a little bit better, but it's still the same old thing of running your app in the background and you have to implement these callbacks and things like that, which I'm not a fan of, as you noticed. And another very, very common task that's not contemplated by any of the background modes Apple offers currently. I say it's very common because I personally never had to implement something like this, but I see it all the time in like the Slack groups I'm a part of when people ask questions. It's usually like, oh, we have this thing in our Android app, and every 2 hours it does this. How do I do it on iOS?
Right, exactly.
And the answer is you don't. Like, it's impossible. And it's such a common thing. Like, I don't have a use for it, but many apps do. Like, to perform a certain operation every X amount of time. Like, of course, that amount of time would have to be something reasonable, not like every millisecond, but and they do have like for instance the timer API has a tolerance property so that the system can schedule timers in a more efficient manner by coalescing timers. So if you have 3 timers and they all fall within like a specific window, you can coalesce those together and wake up the CPU to run those timers at the same time. So if it offered something like that, I think it would be great.
Yeah, I think that would be really great too, because really what I think it's all about is just to kind of give the developer a little bit more power and a little bit more control. Because just take something simple. Let's say you want to build like a timer app, right? That you can set a timer and you can maybe do it in a more custom way than the built-in way. Like, again, there are ways around it. Like, you can schedule a local notification and then that local notification wakes up your app. But again, it feels like you are kind of hacking the system at that point, right?
Yeah.
Like, it would be so much nicer if you could just say, here's my code that I want to run, here's what I want to happen, and here's how I want to alert the user, and not have to kind of create all these different workarounds.
Yeah, and also I think now, especially now that iPad has its own OS, at least in terms of naming, it's called iPad OS, maybe lift some of the restrictions only on iPad, because I think most of the things some developers want to do are more specific to iPad, where people more and more are using the iPad as their main computer, and it doesn't make sense to have the same types of restrictions on iPad as you have on your iPhone, which lives in your pocket. So of course the iPad is also a mobile device, but my MacBook Pro is also a mobile device, and I can write AirBuddy for it with a daemon that runs in the background all the time. So I think iPadOS should have even less restrictions.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But even if all these things that we're now wishing for, and you know, WWDC is just around the corner, so who knows, maybe something will happen in this regard. Even if that does happen, I think there's still a discussion to be had around lazy versus eager loading. So I mentioned before when we started this deep dive that iOS apps in general, I would say, are doing more kind of lazy style loading. And sometimes that's for the best. Like you don't want to, like you said earlier, you don't want to load everything in like your application did finish launching method, because then you are just slowing things down on launch. And if you do get woken up in the background, you're also doing all this maybe redundant work for just a super small operation. So lazy loading has a lot of benefits where you are loading your data or you're performing some operation just when it's needed. But it can also have downsides. And I think one thing that is very commonly seen in iOS apps in this regard is, I like to call it the web browser experience, which is when you're in an iOS app, and this is, we're talking about a native app now. So a completely native app implemented in Swift or Objective-C or any other native technology. You're going to a new screen in the app, and initially the screen is blank. It has a loading spinner, it loads the data, and it shows it. And then you click something in the screen, like a list item, and it goes to a new screen, is blank, loading spinner, shows the data, right? And the reason I call it the web browser experience is because that's kind of how a web browser works. And that is a good thing in terms of web browser, because you can't load the entire internet. You know, we talked about this before we started recording, but, you know, there was these disks early on in the early days of the internet that said, here's the whole internet on a disk, you know, that doesn't work anymore. So the fact that a web browser works like that is great. Like, you don't want to lazy load too much in a web browser. So it's good that when you're only loading the data when the user clicks a link, but you don't want a native app to feel this way. You want it to feel fast. You want it to feel like, you know, responsive when you're going through it, that you're not always just getting into these kind of hurdles where you just have to wait for data to get loaded. And of course, that's something that developers can already address today by just eagerly loading data more. But it's kind of difficult to decide, when do you eagerly load data? Like, do you guess which item that the user is going to tap on? Or, you know, I just wanted to hear, Rambo, what are your thoughts on this? Because you are used to doing a lot more kind of background processing, because you've done a lot more Mac development than I think most of our listeners and me as well. What are your thoughts around this whole debate around eager versus lazy loading data? Do you think that there's already a way for iOS developers to kind of get rid of this web browser type of user experience, or is it just too difficult?
I mean, it's not easy, definitely. But I am a fan of using like heuristics when doing this type of things. So I'm sure, and this of course will depend hugely on your specific app, but I'm sure you can find places in the app you work on where you can probably guess with a certain level of confidence what the user is going to want to look at next. So let's say you have an e-commerce app and you have analytics that show that like 80% of users who open the home screen of the app, you have like a list of featured items, and the most users tap the first item on that list, or all items, or a certain number of items. That's something you would probably want to eagerly load. And then at the same time, you can implement this eager loading, but not do it, say, if the user is on 4G. Only do it if the user is on Wi-Fi. Or don't do it if the user has low power mode enabled. I think there was a WWDC session, was last year or maybe the year before, where they talked about like watching the state of the device and making decisions based on that. And I think very few apps actually do it. And if you do it in your app, you can increase the quality of the user experience quite a bit and make your app more performant and less wasteful at the same time.
And it's easier than you might think to do this, to implement things like that, especially if you're using the URL session APIs directly, because you can use different URL sessions that are configured. There's different flags you can set around if it allows cellular access or not. And that is just so powerful and doesn't require you to write any code of your own. Like, there used to be this class that was on Apple's website called Reachability, right? The Reachability
Pretty much
class.
Every app has this class.
Yeah, exactly. But it's really not needed in many cases anymore, because you can just configure your URL session however you want to perform your request. You can say that this should be allowed on a cellular connection, this should not. And you can even set flags like you should wait until a connection is available. So if you have something where you say, this should only happen on Wi-Fi, but and it's a syncing operation or something that can be kind of delayed, then you can even say, perform this when the user comes online on this particular configuration. So it's really, really powerful. And I've been meaning to write about this for a long time. I still haven't, but maybe this week. We'll see. Maybe next week. Well, there's a lot of other things to write about.
Yeah, and also utilizing things such as Shocker, the HTTP protocol, John. Have you heard about it?
Yeah. I have heard about it. I've read some ancient scriptures about this HTTP protocol.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's so sad that like very few APIs out there actually utilize the HTTP protocol, and the same goes for apps. And by utilizing, of course, you're using it, you're making HTTP requests, but I'm talking about like returning 200 when there was an error and returning the error code in the body instead of returning the actual error code in the HTTP header, which is what it's made for.
Yep.
And that's not just important in terms of correctness and like, oh, let me be pure and use HTTP, but it's also important in terms of giving hints to the URL loading system, which on iOS is extremely complex. Like the URL loading system on Apple's platforms is extremely complicated, and it does a lot of very smart things on your behalf. And if you don't give it the right hints, it may not do what you want. So please use the right HTTP methods and HTTP codes in responses, and use things such as if modified since and e tags and things like that. Like for instance, for the timeline tab in Chibi Studio, we eagerly load the contents of that tab because so that if you tap it, it doesn't have to load. And also because we show a badge if there's a new item you haven't seen. The badge is, you can turn off the badge, by the way. I don't like badges, so I give my users the choice as well. But we use HTTP as it should be used, and like 99% of the time, that eager loading is going to just result in a 304 response, which is not modified. So we are eagerly loading, but that doesn't mean that the server is going to like explode with bandwidth usage or anything like that.
Exactly. And I think that's a really, really good point that, you know, utilizing the built-in caching mechanisms in HTTP they're really powerful and they are universal. So if you implement them in your server, you can use it on all sorts of platforms, on Android, iOS, Mac, etc. Like, this is not something that I would recommend that you code logic for in your iOS app in Swift, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is something that should be implemented kind of on the network layer itself, like the actual HTTP stack, and utilizing all the tools that already exist around it, because I joke that HTTP comes from ancient scriptures, but it is pretty old at this point in a good way. Like, it's established, there are conventions, and we should just follow them, right?
Yeah, it's solid.
Exactly. So hopefully with all these things we've talked about, we can both do what we can in our apps with the current tools that exists to, you know, be able to do a better decision around eager loading, or to be able to do eager loading in the first place without consuming a lot of resources. And also hopefully there will be some APIs from Apple in the future to enable more powerful background operations apart from those that already exists.
Yeah, I'd also like to refer our users back to a previous conversation we had about not showing a loading spinner until you have to. Which is something you can do if your response time is really fast on the thing you're loading. Even if you are lazily loading, you can avoid showing a spinner until you notice that it's necessary. And a good tool to hide a loading state is an animation. If you have like a half a second animation, which is really short, transitioning between selecting something and showing something, and your content loads in 300 milliseconds, you don't have to show a loading spinner. You can just show the content.
Exactly, because so many times slowness is perceived, right?
Yeah.
and sometimes you can mask slowness as well. Like if you're working on something that is inherently slow, like it's not that you implemented something in an inefficient way. It might just be that the web server you're talking to is slow or that the network connection is slow. Like there are circumstances that can make things slow that are kind of beyond our control. So like you're saying, utilizing animations, like utilizing some level of heuristics around when to display a loading spinner, maybe not. Like I see sometimes apps, they create these elaborate loading spinners, which draw a lot of attention to themselves. And yeah. I'm like, do you really want your users to focus on how slow your app is to load, right? Like probably not. So yeah, there's a lot of tricks and just design things in general and user experience principles that we can use to make this better.
Yeah, the only times I like to use custom loading spinners is when you're giving the user a reward. If you, coming back to the e-commerce example, if you're loading while you're processing the purchase, that's a place where I would use a custom loading spinner, because in the end you can like morph it into a check mark or something, kind of like the Apple Pay loading spinner.
Right, exactly.
In those cases it's good. Otherwise, if you're just loading content, I would suggest not using it. And I think there's some research that's been done that like when you use the standard activity indicator, the user, quote, blames the slowness on their device and not on in the app. And if you use a custom spinner, they blame it on your app. I think there's been some research around that.
That sounds funny. So, Rambo, what you're saying is that in a Mac app, you should always just show the beach ball whenever you're loading your data.
That would be perfect. Please.
You heard it here on Stack Trace first. We're being ironic, just to clarify. All right, great. So now with that deep dive behind us, that was really fun. I really enjoyed this new segment that we have with these deep dives. So yeah, we're going to keep it up and let us know if you want us to do any particular deep dives in the future. But now let's answer a question from our wonderful audience using our hashtag AskStackTrace. And someone who has asked us a question using that hashtag on Twitter is Lonnie. And Lonnie wants to hear, at what point in our career did we feel comfortable making unique architectural choices? Because Lonnie says that, I feel like my apps are just a big collage of different architectures and design patterns that I've found by looking through other code bases with slight adjustments. So I think this is a very, very good question, because it can be really tricky sometimes to decide, do I go with something custom, which is tailored for my app, which will probably perform better or be a better fit for what I'm trying to build, at the cost of maybe having a steeper learning curve for people who join my team? So what's your take on this, Rambo? Like, first of all, at what point in your career did you actually start, like, you know, going away from just the standards and things you read about or heard from other people, and actually started like doing your unique system design?
Well, first of all, I don't think my system design is that unique. But
you're not using the Rambo pattern?
No. No, so I'm not using the Rambo pattern, but like I mentioned before, I like to stick to mostly MVC with some extra stuff around it. If you want to hear about a specific point, I think it was like circa 2016 that I figured out that I knew enough to be able to like create my own patterns or adapt what was there to my specific needs. But talking about the collage of different architectures, I think this is kind of something that people worry about when they're getting started, but it shouldn't really be something you worry about. I think every code base out there is to some extent a collection of different patterns. Architecture itself is a bigger topic, so if you have like four different architectures in one app, I think then you have a problem. But if you have like one specific flow within your app that uses a different architecture than the rest of the app, I don't think that's like a huge issue or a sign that your code base is doomed. And in terms of patterns, they are fine to be used with other patterns. Like you can combine several different patterns. And that's why I kind of get confused when people ask me what pattern I use, like all of them. I think that's very common in all code bases. But you are the pattern and architecture person here, John. So I want to hear your opinion as well.
Yeah. So first of all, it is very, very common, just like you mentioned as well. Like when you are a beginner or a more junior developer, or you're in the beginning of your career, it's very common to just want to take an approach that you have heard, or it feels like it's like working and it's a standard and it's something that a lot of people use, because it kind of gives you confidence as well, right? Like if you are a beginner, you are kind of usually not that confident to make your own decisions or go out on your own path and say, you know, let me invent this thing or design this particular architecture, this system for my app, because, you know, you might not feel like you have those skills yet, or you don't feel comfortable doing that, or you don't want to paint yourself into a corner. So you try to take something more that feels established. The problem with that phrase, feels established, is that that tends to change a lot very quickly. And it also tends to vary depending on who you ask. So some people are fans of, you know, some particular patterns, or particular architecture styles, particular techniques. And depending on who you ask, you might get a completely different answer, or you might just get that classic, it depends answer, right? So then it can be kind of frustrating, like, just tell me what to use. And what you eventually usually realize as you progress through your career, and I guess this is what Lonnie is asking here in this question, is that you realize that all software is very different, and it's hard to find these kind of silver bullet solutions. So you start prioritizing more adapting patterns, like you mentioned, Rambo, or combining them or using them in different shapes and forms. And that's something that you kind of just have to naturally grow into, I think. I think it's hard to just like get that experience unless we end up in the Matrix, where you can just like press a button, you know, like they do in the Matrix. Like, now I want to learn this language. Now I want to learn this thing. Now I want to download all of the experience from all the iOS developers directly into my mind and go for it.
That would be great.
It would be pretty great. Yeah. So like for me personally, what happened was that I also was like you. And I guess that would be my number one recommendation in general, is that if you're in doubt, if you don't know what to use, if you don't feel confident making these kind of architectural decisions, if you don't feel like you have that experience, I would always recommend trying to stick with what the system provides. And the reason for that is that the system tends to change at a much slower pace than the rest of kind of the community and the rest of the architectural patterns and techniques that you find out there. And then you can start to kind of ease your way into the kind of sprinkling those different patterns on top of what the system offers. So I think that's why, you know, me and Rambo, we're often saying that, you know, start with MVC. And it's not because we think that MVC is the perfect architecture and it solves all the problems. It's because it's what the system is built around. And if you need to start with something, that's a good starting point. And then as you kind of, you know, advance through your career, as you learn more things, and as you learn how to combine these building blocks, you can start doing that. But I think starting with adopting all sorts of different architectures that you hear about today because they're hyped and they're cool and, you know, someone just released them and made a big kind of marketing splash around it, that can be great. Those architecture patterns can be good, but it's usually a riskier bet than going with what the system offers and then easing your way into designing your own patterns that are custom made for your app on top of that.
Yeah. I'll also refer once again to my talk at .swift, which was about architecture, because the entire goal, like the main goal of that talk, was to give developers, especially beginners, peace of mind that they are going to be fine and they don't have to worry so much about which architecture they pick. Because like you mentioned, these patterns and architectures we see around, they can give you more confidence, and you see there's a company that's using it, or there are developers you like who are using it. And you feel like if you use it, you're going to be, quote, like them. But that's not necessarily the case. And sometimes people associate the end result with what was used to make the thing. And I give the example of the photography community, where it's common for someone to share a beautiful picture and people ask about which camera was used, which lens was used, and that's not the point.
Right, exactly. And just another final point from me here on this is that one way to kind of mitigate the problem of having a collage of different architectures is to do more prototyping. Because I get it, like, I'm the same. I get excited about different techniques. I write about new techniques every single week, and they're not always like, here's how to re-architect your app. Actually, it's almost never that. It's more, you know, here's a particular technique you can use for this particular purpose, or as a, you know, overall way of thinking. But, you know, it's very common to want to try new things and to grow as a developer, or just to try new trends and things like that. And that's what I use prototyping for a lot. Like, I do a lot of prototypes with different kinds of architecture styles, different techniques. And it can be something where you just check out a new branch in your project and you just start adopting the thing you just heard about or the thing you want to try out there and see how it works out. Because that also enables you to kind of try something out in a more safe environment, and then you can always just go back to your master branch if that didn't work out, or if you don't feel like this is a good fit for your app. And that's also a way to kind of more rapidly gain this experience that we just talked about, because you will start noticing trends among different patterns, and you will kind of start noticing that all of these different patterns, they're just kind of different takes and trade-offs on the same kind of fundamental problem. And that kind of experience and that insight is really, really valuable. So I would really recommend that, you know, try as many things as you can and be open-minded, but do so in an environment where you're not necessarily just like putting everything in production immediately.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. And I think that's a great note to end this episode on. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. And we also, again, want to just give a shout out to everybody who used the hashtag #ShareStackTrace over the last few weeks to share our podcast with friends and followers on social media, on Twitter, etc. It was just really, really nice to see. And we have now selected a winner of our mentorship session, and we have notified the winner. So if you didn't get a message from us, unfortunately, you didn't win this time, but I think, you know, if I speak for myself here, Rambo, I think we definitely want to do something like this again, because it was just so wonderful to see everybody share our show. And even if we won't have another competition lined up right now, if you want to help us out, like, one way to do that is to share our show. Like, even if you don't have a lot of followers, that doesn't matter. It's just so nice to see people talk about what they like about StackTrace, to give us feedback, and just to share it with their friends.
Definitely.
Fantastic. And that's it for this episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.
And let's just double check the disk space, like always, my routine. Yeah, 31 gigs available.
Wow.
That's like 31 gigs. That's like a whole country worth of gigabytes.
Ooh,
for me.
Amazing.
I can download the whole internet. Did you remember, or maybe you're too young, now I'm sounding like an old man, but do you remember when there used to be these CD drives or CDs you used to be able to buy, which had the whole internet on them?
I don't remember, but I saw a video about that recently.
I remember, like, not getting one of those called, like, this is the internet, but things like all the encyclopedias and all, like, lots of, like, discs with images and things like that. I remember it was, yeah.
Yeah, I remember in the video I watched, it was something like, see what the internet is like.
Exactly.